You're listening to my radio at stanpelke.com. Hello again. Thanks for joining me for my fourth podcast. I'm Stan Pelke, your host at my radio. Today, I will be reading the second half of Chapter 2 of my original science fiction novel, Project Earth, Dawn of Defiance. So far, the novel may feel like historical fiction coupled with a ghost story. Rest assured, there will be major twists and turns with ever more science fiction elements as we move into chapters 3 and 4. I am also already leaving clues that all may not be as it seems. Please check back regularly for new content and additional podcasts. In the end, enlisting in the paratroopers with Sherman had made so much sense, and not just for the better pay. Charlie could not risk having Sherman spiral back down into despair and the alcohol abuse that had almost claimed his life several times in the past few years. And so they had headed off together to survive basic training at Camp Croft in North Carolina. They continued to provide moral support to each other as they trained as paratroopers at Camp Tocoa. They had survived the extensive physical training and development of military discipline, the long runs, the endless awful camp food, the good officers and the bad ones. Along the way, the two New York country boys welcomed other farmers-turned-warriors from across the country into a tight-knit circle. Together, they were preparing to invade Nazi-occupied Europe. It was growing lighter. Pink-tinted light was collecting on the horizon. Charlie could just make out the first hints of the sun if he turned in his seat and peered around Sherman and through the windows on the right-hand side of the train. Gently rolling farmland spread out all around them now in all directions. As they roared through another sleepy Tennessee village, illuminated ever more fully by the dawn, Charlie saw a few rusty farm trucks already taking to the road as hired hands began to head out of town toward the fields of soybeans and cotton. It was more beautiful country than Charlie had ever imagined. He loved the North Country, the Adirondacks, the lakes and streams on which he'd fished with his father when he was very young, and his grandfather's farm to the north of Malone. But this was something lovely in a new way, and for some reason he felt at home. The richness of the land, the lushness of the fields, and the rolling landscape were both strange and familiar. That day passed like others had, the train racing ever further northward, and gradually the towns becoming larger. And as morning turned to noonday, each town that they passed through was more awake or alive than the last. Charlie and Sherman shared sandwiches they had bought at a station somewhere in northern Georgia the night before, and washed them down with coffee provided to all the men on the train. As the sun began to set out the windows to their left, the train slowed as it made its final approach to Sturgis, Kentucky, where entire regiments of infantrymen, including paratroopers, were gathering for a month of extensive drills, exercises, and war games. There was much jostling and elbowing as the train halted and everyone began to stand up and collect his things. The soldiers were happy to be finished with the ride, and they were anxious to actually get off the train again, having moved steadily along since the brief pause the evening before in Georgia. Charlie and Sherman were chattering excitedly about what the next month might hold for them when Charlie's breath suddenly caught in his throat and he choked back a spontaneous gasp. The platform onto which he was about to land, at the rear of the station, seemed to tilt away from him, the stairway of the train becoming inconsequential beneath his feet, and the walls shimmered and reshaped themselves into those of the platform and station from his dream. Charlie stopped so abruptly that Sherman ran into him as Charlie's tall friend tried to disembark. "Whoa, hey, what's up, Charlesy?" For a moment there was no answer. Sherman finally prodded Charlie forward down the last stairs and onto the platform. The moment Charlie actually stepped onto the concrete, everything righted itself and he snapped back into the moment. Sorry, Sherm, sorry. Strange feeling for a moment. The training in Sturgis was intense and exhausting, so much so that Charlie actually slept soundly each night for several weeks. And then on one of the final days of the extended war games, Charlie and Sherman and the other members of their platoon were ordered to take the crossroads of a small rural village that had been purpose-built in a clearing in the forest. Charlie stared in disbelief as they reached the edge of the woods to the south of the simulated farm village. There were about 15 buildings of various sizes clustered around at four corners, newly paved for the exercises. To their right, on the western side of the village, was a large barn with a small farmhouse beside it. A simple church was at the center of the village. Other houses stretched along the north-south road. A few shops clustered on the east road. At the end of the village to the east was another farmhouse and a second, smaller barn. The fabricated village was impressive on its own. It was almost like the movie sets he had seen depicted in newsreels before the main attraction at the theater back home. But it was the large barn to the west that had caught Charlie's attention. There, standing boldly before the barn doors, was his spectral nemesis, blank eyes staring toward Charlie's hiding place in the woods. Its decaying limbs were folded over the wreck of its torso. Spidery, wispy hair was streaming out in the wind behind its head. No one else noticed anything unusual. They were busily debating tactics for approaching the barn across the open field between the woods and the building, capturing and securing it. "That's the obvious place to start first," one soldier argued. "On the edge, good view of the crossroads, upper story. We can wait there for reinforcements coming from the eastern road." "That's crazy," another replied. "Church has an upper floor too, and it's closer to the crossroads." "Yeah, but we gotta get past all those houses to get there." The debate continued, and all the while, the spectral creature guarded the barn, unseen by any but Charlie. This was a new experience. His dream was becoming a waking nightmare. And then the world tipped or slipped out from under him, and for a moment, for Charlie only, the village disappeared. He could see a vast meadow stretching to the far horizon, with a huge field of corn planted on its closest edge. At the edge of the cornfield, men dressed in animal skins were throwing stones and spears at a small group of soldiers in black uniforms and black helmets, who were shooting at the far larger party of spear throwers with some sort of machine guns. Charlie grabbed Sherman's arm, partly to steady himself, partly to try to get his attention. "Easy, Corporal Spear!" Sherman's voice pulled Charlie's attention away from the field for just a moment. When he looked back, the village had returned, but the ghostly being was still there, standing before the barn. Charlie swallowed hard, gathered his thoughts, and said, "We can't go for the barn. They're in there." "What are you talking about? How do you know?" Voices were raised in rapid and overlapping queries. "You see something? Trust me, it's a trap. We gotta go through the woods, further westward, then come out behind the barn and ambush them from the rear." "That weren't the directions for the war games."
"That's not gonna work."
"Directions? The Germans aren't gonna hand us their plans so we know how to react. I'm telling you, it's too obvious. That other unit is waiting in there for us. They'll be ready to defend it for the same reasons we want it." The debate continued for another several minutes as Sergeant Livernois tried to make up his mind. He had no reason to trust Charlie on this one, but out of a sense of deep loyalty, he finally agreed and set the men in a tactical column. They headed off westward under cover of the woods for another quarter mile.
"Yeah!"
Cheers went up into the rafters of the mess hall several hours later as Charlie's platoon celebrated their unexpected victory in the war games. From all directions, shouts of, "How'd you know?"
"That was
and
a great
That was
move.
A sharp plan." And, "We can't be beat."
"That's right."
Swirled around Charlie. Even he felt
Keep
giddy from the success. But it was easier just to nod thanks to all the well-wishers in the company than to say anything about what had tipped him off, as their captain had said. "Well played, Livernois," the captain's voice boomed. "And keep up those careful observations, Spear." After a time, Charlie wandered over to the edge of the large makeshift wooden building and looked out into the night. Crude barracks and innumerable tents stretched down the large clearing in the Kentucky woods. Several tall light poles had been constructed, their lamps fighting back against the rural darkness. It was hotter in the evenings than he liked, much hotter than the warm evenings with cool breezes back in the North Country. Still, he breathed deeply of the warm, humid air and thought about all that had happened in the past year. He was about to return to the celebration when he saw the specter shimmering beneath one of the lamp poles. This time, though, it wasn't looking at Charlie. Its death gaze was locked on a young man kneeling on the ground directly beneath the lamp. Charlie turned to call Sherman and found his friend already beside him. "What's up, Charlesy?"
"Sherm, it's the caped man."
"Huh? The caped man, over there by the light. And someone's with him. What's you saying, caped man?" Charlie pointed furiously, but as he looked back toward the light, the figures were gone. 634971.
"What? Charlesy, you drink too much tonight?"
"Maybe, yeah. That's it. I think I'll turn in." The tent he shared with Sherman was sweltering. The mosquitoes were relentless. He would not have slept anyway. The waking image of the specter was far more unsettling than the haunted dream ever was. And now this strange string of numbers. 634971. By the time Sherman stumbled to bed, Charlie had muttered that sequence 71 times to himself. "Dear God," he whispered, "please don't let me go crazy." Mail call the next afternoon brought a letter from home and some relief. "June 3rd, 1943. My dearest Charlie, I hope this letter finds you well. I miss you very much, but was so happy to receive your last two letters. I'll make sure to catch you up in the next few weeks. First, some news. I gave up the rented house like we discussed before you left for Kentucky. I have taken two rooms at Mrs. Henderson's. I could barely squeeze the furniture into one room, but the second is comfy and the rent is cheap. I am cooking Mrs. Henderson's dinner and helping with light cleaning in exchange for a few dollars off the bill. I also got a job. Lots of women are working now that so many men are being called up. It's part-time at the post office. I put in a 4-hour shift 4 days each week. It's perfect between that and helping Mrs. Henderson. I'm even able to save a few dollars each week. So don't you worry about me. I'm being careful, but have plenty to eat. Mrs. Henderson planted a very large vegetable garden this spring, and I have plenty to do. I do miss listening to some of my radio programs, but I do the best I can to keep Mrs. Henderson company in the evenings. I've also learned what happened to her son I've heard about but never met. He was a medical student back in 1917 and volunteered for the war. Came home a changed man and did not want to practice medicine. He drifted off west to California in 1927 or 28. Mrs. Henderson hears from him once or twice a year. She's not seen him since Mr. Henderson died. Anyway, Mrs. H. kept all of his medical school books. I asked her if I could look through them. She laughed at that and said, "Whatever for, dear?" I explained to her that I was still hoping to go to college when you return home and that I was interested in mathematics. She laughed again, but said I was welcome to them if I could make any sense of them. Well, of course I can, and they are wonderful. So I'm working hard like I know you are, and I am saving and I am studying. Oh, and I am depositing all the money you're sending home. I think there's almost a semester's tuition saved now. It's a good start. I'll close for the time being. I need to be at the post office early tomorrow. I'll stamp this to you myself. My heart is yours, Charlie. And yours is mine. Love always, your Gloria Jane. Charlie Spear woke with a start, shallow, quick breathing, and his heart racing so furiously that his chest hurt and a dull pain was already forming at his temples. In the darkness, disoriented, he reached for something, anything familiar, and felt her warm arm. It was soft and reassuring, and at his touch, she stirred and sighed, sounds he knew and loved as her body moved closer to his, and the bed shifted and the floor creaked. How many times now had he dreamt that nightmare? As his eyes focused more thoroughly and he became more alert, and as what seemed to be dark of night resolved into gray of early dawn, Corporal Charlie Spear began to recognize his surroundings. He was not at home. He had not been home for years. Charlie's mind focused. 38 times now the dream had come, unbidden. Sometimes there were long stretches of nights when he did not dream the dream. Other times he was haunted night after night after night. And of all the nights, this was not the one on which to lose sleep. It was June 5th, 1944. He was only hours away from finally making the jump into Hitler's Fortress Europe. Charlie looked down at his hands. They were shaking. That was something new.
Perhaps after the stress of all the training and the anticipation of the invasion, perhaps that was the reason. But he wondered if the real reason was that he was going mad. Touched, his grandfather would have said. Was he touched, like the old war veteran back home who used to stumble around town mumbling and muttering and looking for something precious he had lost? Was he going insane? 634971. 634971 Gamma. 634971 Gamma Frame 2. 634971 Gamma Frame 2, Subsection 3. And now these sequences of numbers and meaningless words had begun to roll through his head repeatedly, once a day. Charlie thought of Gloria Jane, her beautiful smile and lovely auburn hair, her soft body and warm disposition, the little ones he had wanted to parent with her, the farm he'd hoped to buy back, and the partnership he'd finally be able to form with Sherman and Billy Clayton. What would happen to her if he died in France? What would happen to her if he really did go completely over the edge? I need to say something to someone. Who? A doctor. Maybe Dr. Gerhardt. That's crazy. Dr. Gerhardt does not exist. Monsieur Benoit? Wait, no. That's crazy too. What's crazy? It was Sherman. He'd sauntered up and was standing in the sunlight, casting his long shadow over Charlie's pained chest and tense face. Nothing. I think I was dreaming. Looks like we're gonna really do it this time, Sherman chortled. His right eye twitched ever so slightly when he became overexcited or overnervous. Chances were he was feeling both right now. Help me up. Sherman extended his hand, and Charlie hoisted himself up. Must be those air sickness pills making me dream, Charlie said. Yeah, I'd be dreaming too if I had that pretty wife of yours. Sherman laughed his big, charming laugh and punched Charlie in the shoulder. We'll be fine, Charlesy. We'll be fine so long as we stick together. Ain't that right? June 6th, 1944. D-Day. Charlie Spear and Sherman Livernois participated in the early morning parachute drops behind enemy lines. Like so many others from the airborne divisions, they ended up separated and scattered all over Normandy. Though the invasion was a military success, it came with a cost for the men who survived the jumps and the beaches, mind-numbing images of death and destruction, military and civilian casualties, many horrific. These were spread over the next several days. Charlie Spear wished he could go home, or roll up, fall asleep, and never awaken. Days of fighting followed after the Normandy beach landings. Charlie had finally rejoined Sherman and about 10 other men from his company on June 8th, just in time for the general regrouping and preparation for the Battle of Carentan, which began on June 10th. Charlie Spear, like so many other American, British, and Canadian troopers, was simply exhausted, and exhausted beyond anything he had experienced before throughout that fatal week. And now everywhere Charlie went, his ever-dead nemesis followed. Charlie would catch sight of his ghost out of the corner of his eye, turn, and see the wispy lengths of corpse hair slip just in time behind a barn, or a stone wall, or a hedgerow. It was only a matter of time before Charlie would become that corpse-like ghost. On June 20th, 1944, 14 days after D-Day, Charlie's company was ordered forward with three others to take Saint-Sophie-sur-Douve, yet another small French town. They had made it safely through several kilometers of open fields without incident and without losses. Now they were looking out across the main road leading into the town from behind the relative safety of the last small farmhouse before countryside turned into lightly settled town outskirts. Much of Saint-Sophie-sur-Douve was still intact, especially the houses, churches, and shops on the streets that lined both sides of the Douve River to their right, but the buildings closest to them had suffered from some Allied bombing during the past 2 days. Many of the streets that they could see were littered with rubble from partially collapsed buildings, fallen lampposts, electric poles and telephone poles, and hastily abandoned bicycles, carts, baskets, and even a few cars. The roofs of two especially tall buildings toward the center of town, perhaps apartment buildings or government offices, had completely collapsed, leaving only the wooden rafters jutting up into the sky like the bones of two vast dead carcasses. The American soldiers had seen no sign of people, living or dead, neither French town folk nor German occupiers. The objective is to capture these five buildings, their captain had explained during the briefing. This large church, clear out any snipers in the bell tower, the main municipal building, the warehouse on the north side of town, this small hospital, and this rail station. Charlie Spear's platoon would take the rail station. They checked their gear and rifles one more time. Some said their own silent prayers. Sherman stumbled up to Charlie with a determined but grim expression on his usually jovial face. Even Sherman Livernoyce had been changed by their experiences that past week. He nodded supportively in Charlie's direction, then took up his usual position as the radio man beside their lieutenant. The order was given. The American troops poured out from behind the last little farmhouse and into the narrow strip of vegetable gardens between them and the first layer of houses on the closest edge of town. Enemy shots now began buzzing all around them. Bullets whizzed past Charlie's head. Two troopers were hit in the shoulder and leg and were pulled to safety as the company pulled up alongside the first houses in town. Their captain ordered their machine gunners and one of the troop squads to fan out to the right flank. Charlie's lieutenant ordered Charlie and Sherman and their squad to the left. Bullets poured down on them as they left the safety of the houses and darted across the road toward the second row of houses. American machine guns now opened up, ripping apart the upper story of a tall, two-story tailor shop three streets away from which most of the German shots were coming. A rocket grenade exploded against the uppermost eaves, and in the confusion and covered by the smoke, Charlie's squad burst out from hiding, firing, and pushed down yet another street. Houses and stores behind them were being checked and cleared. To the left, he saw another squad race up toward the central square and the principal municipal building. As the large church tower came into view, sure enough, sniper fire began popping on the walls and pavement around them. German artillery roared overhead, answered by American mortars fired from the fields they had crossed. The church tower took two hits. Shingles crumbled and collapsed into the street. Charlie and his warrior brothers fired on the glass windows of the church. Angry German voices bellowed and enemy fire ricocheted all around them. Another American was hit. This time, seriously. A third American squad now came into view from the right and ran right up to the church, taking up crouching positions beneath the remnants of the stained glass. Five grenade pins were pulled and five grenades were tossed. Americans dove for cover. Explosions inside the holy place. The sergeant barked for them to move forward. Others were now firing on the stunned or wounded Germans. Shots all around them, and another American trooper fell to the ground. They ran up another side street, smashing in doors and firing shots into darkened spaces. At one building, a bakery storefront, two Germans had lurched out at them with bayonets after the Americans broke down the door. Ted Stevens, a private from Cleveland, was caught in the gut and fell back, bellowing in rage and agony. Charlie Spear seemed to watch himself react. Fire a shot, one German down. Turn the rifle and drive the butt into the face of the other, second German down. Another trooper appeared beside him and shot both enemy soldiers. They then drew Ted back against the wall, applied sulfur powder to the wound, and pressed bandages against his heavily bleeding abdomen. Their lieutenant had doubled back now, taken stock of the situation, then ordered Charlie forward with him. The sound of fighting was intense off to the left, down near the municipal building. To their right, a squad and several stragglers were regrouping before a final push toward the rail station. Charlie was nearly out of breath and at wit's end, though rejoining Sherman lifted his spirits. His friend's temple had been grazed by a bullet. One of their medics was just tying off a bandage, but Sherman was reassuring their captain he could press on. "I'll be all right. Tell him, Charlesy," he kept saying. "Okay, men, here we go." The seven men stormed out from both sides of the small shop behind which they had momentarily sought refuge and raced across the wide road toward the front of the train station. Charlie nearly fell over in disbelief as the familiar dream sight came into view. It was his train station, two distinctive octagonal towers soaring upward at the front. His moment of stunned hesitation saved him. Several German potato mashers landed amongst the three men he had moments ago been running beside and sent them flying in all directions. None survived the blasts. The noise and smoke shattered his momentary stupor, and Charlie Spear dashed the final meters to the station's front entrance. He was now in the lead. He battered open the doors with the butt of his rifle and lobbed one, two grenades into the space. Explosions sent debris flying. A boot and the partial remnant of a leg crashed into his chest, and Charlie fell backward against the plaster wall in shock and dismay. He could do no more. As he slid down the wall and began to gag with disgust and panicked exhaustion, the last three men still standing from his platoon tore past him and into the station lobby. Sherman Livernoise was not among them. This was an original work of music and text by Stan Pelkey. Please note that any unauthorized broadcasting, public performance, copying, or re-recording of this program, its story, or its music is an infringement of copyright.